It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This week, we're hearing from Wisconsin's U.S. senators about developments from Capitol Hill, including reaction to a new wave of U.S. airstrikes on Iran. We heard from Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin earlier in the week, and yesterday we checked in with Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. We begin with the Iran war. The U.S. and Israel attacked Iran more than 100 days ago, starting a months-long war. Now we hear President Trump saying the U.S. is launching very hard new strikes on Iran. Tehran would have to pay the price. Is there a realistic path to bring this war to an end quickly?
Well, let me correct you. You said that the U.S. and Israel started this war. No, this war was started 47 years ago by the Ayatollahs when they declared war on the West. They have, through their proxies, and directly killed hundreds of U.S. service members, more than 1,000 Israelis just in the October 7th attack. So again, this is a war declared on America. I have viewed for quite some years Iran as an existential threat to America if they become a nuclear power, if they get a nuclear weapon. They've got missile technology. They could lob a missile with a nuclear warhead over a continental U.S., explode it. That's an EMP attack, wipes out our grid. That's existential. So every president since President Clinton said that Iran can't have a nuclear weapon, Obama and Biden coddled the Ayatollahs, funneling billions into their economy, their military, into their proxies. President Trump was the only one who made the very tough, and it was a very tough decision, to try and end this war for all time, and I support his efforts. I cannot wait for the Ayatollahs to be on the dustbin of history. The stability, the peace it would bring to the region and the world will be tremendous. But it's tough. They've got the mosaic defense. They've got the guns. The Ayatollahs, the brutal dictators have the guns. Unfortunately, the Iranian people have been held captive for 47 years as well.
Are you putting any pressure on President Trump to end this war?
He's the commander in chief. I'm not putting any pressure on him. I'm supporting his efforts, and I pray for him. President Trump hates war. The reason he has been so patient with Iran, trying to find somebody that has the power to do it and the rationality to do a deal for the benefit of the Iranian people is because, he doesn't want to see anybody killed. But I think they pushed his patience too far, and I think that's what you're seeing in the current actions. Again, I, for one, hope he succeeds. It's very disheartening when we see his political opponents literally wishing for failure, it seems like. And that's aiding and abetting the enemy. I hope President Trump succeeds.
Let's talk about the price tag here. Pentagon officials estimated a month ago the total cost of the war had reached $29 billion. Would you support a House measure that would require the Defense Department to issue a report on the total cost of U.S. operations in Iran?
Well, at some point in time, we should definitely get that information. Right now, I want the Pentagon to wage and win the war.
Let's look at how this is affecting Wisconsinites. This war is causing farmers in Wisconsin to incur record high diesel prices in the Midwest, surging fertilizer costs. How do you think the government should help farmers weather the costs of this war?
Well, again, I have to remind you and your listeners that in June of 2022, because of President Biden and the Democrats' policy, they're waging the war on fossil fuels, average gasoline prices were $5 a gallon. I don't like the high fuel prices, the high fertilizer prices, nor does President Trump, nor do any of us. But I also recognize that what would be far worse is if Iran became a nuclear power and they wiped out our grid. That would be orders and orders of magnitude worse as well. So hopefully this is just short-term pain. It is painful. I recognize that. But that's why the sooner we win this war, the better for everybody.
What about households here? I mean, you're talking about short-term pay. On average, households have spent $750 more in expenses due to the Iran war, and that is from Moody's Analytics. What do you tell people who no longer have enough money, gas money, to commute to and from their jobs each day?
Well, again, I'll point out, I don't recall the media hounding Democrat politicians when their policies, their fear-mongering on climate change and their war on fossil fuel drove average energy prices up to $5 a gallon, and we experienced 9% inflation, 40-year high inflation. I just don't recall the legacy media hounding Democrat lawmakers. What do you say about that? But it's a fair question. And again, I'll go back to the answer. Iran was an existential threat. So this pain, I recognize it. I hope it is short-lived as possible. But if President Trump succeeds, the peace and stability it will bring to not only the region, but the world will be a tremendous, tremendous achievement. And again, I'm hoping he succeeds.
What is short-term in your mind?
Well, months. Okay. I mean, I truly believe, because I know how much President Trump hates war, he's the president in my lifetime the least likely to engage in a long-term type of ground war. He doesn't want to do that again. That's why he's been so long-suffering, so patient, trying to find somebody in Iran that was rational enough and had enough power against the people who have the guns to actually negotiate a settlement for the benefit of the Iranian people.
We're talking with Wisconsin Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about the latest news from Congress and national politics. Turning to Social Security retirement, the trust fund reportedly gone by 2032, according to a new report from the trustees of the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. That's earlier than we thought. How do you think Congress should replenish or maintain that fund?
Well, the first thing we need to do is return to a reasonable pre-pandemic level spending. It's what I pushed for during our first reconciliation bill. And I laid out different options, going back to Clinton in 1998, Obama in 2014, Trump in 2019. Take the actual outlays of those years, increase them by population growth and inflation, leaving Social Security and Medicare and interest alone, spend what you need to spend. Instead of $7.5 trillion this year, we would be spending somewhere around $5.5 to $6.5 trillion, dramatically reducing our deficit so that we would have the wherewithal to honor those promises to Social Security recipients when the trust fund runs out. That is the first thing we have to do, and then focus on economic growth. Grow revenue through economic growth. Raising taxes is going to harm economic growth and be counterproductive.
So Congress could fix the shortfall by raising payroll tax rate, reducing benefits, or a combination of those things.
I reject that. I don't think that would work. When you tax something, you get less of it. So you start increasing the FICA tax and we'll have more people drop out of the workforce. We already have a big problem. Something like 20% of the working age male population is permanently out of the workforce, partly because we make that possible with pretty generous welfare benefit programs that are, you know, in programs that we are seeing significant fraud. The lowest estimate for fraud is $250 billion from GAO. LexisNexis, I didn't realize they did this research, they pegged the figure to $1 trillion. And we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg in Minnesota, in California. We need to rein in that fraud. That is significant savings, but it's probably going to require Congress to start reining in these programs. You can't recover it through prosecutions. You have to stop the money from flowing to the fraudsters. We had Dr. Oz identified that a third of hospice centers are in Los Angeles, a third of the national hospice centers. He stopped payment to 400 of them. Not one complained.
So you're saying fraud.
Which means they were all fraudulent. So we've got a massive fraud problem in federal government spending. We need to address that.
Okay, so you think fraud could fix the system as well as cuts to entitlement programs?
It could go a long way toward fixing it if we were serious about it and if we stopped the spigot so it never goes off to the fraudsters. Some of this fraud, by the way, is being perpetrated by foreign actors. They're looking at the lack of control within our benefit programs here, and they're taking advantage of it.
Okay, speaking of benefit.
It's a serious issue. It's got to be addressed.
Speaking of benefit programs, you blocked a bipartisan veterans benefits bill called the Major Richard Starr Act. It would allow over 50,000 veterans injured in combat to receive retirement and disability benefits. What would it take to get you on board?
Well, first of all, I blocked it because it was trying to be passed by unanimous consent without debate, without discussion, without input by the Committee of Jurisdictions, the Armed Services Committee, or the Pentagon. And at the point in time, the Pentagon was opposed to it. By the way, the chairman of the Armed Services had vetoed or had objected to one in October 2025 when the bill was going to cost something like $7 billion. The time that Richard Blumenthal tried to pass it by unanimous consent, the price tag was up to $75 billion. Again, no debate, no discussion, no input by the Pentagon, no input by the Armed Services Committee. So just recently, Richard Blumenthal tried to do it again, trying to score political points. Rather than work the bill the way it should be worked, through a regular order process. By the way, the revision to it now is going to be somewhere between $10 and $17 billion. So we don't even know what changes he's making. So again, he's trying to pass it. He's trying to bypass the regular order. Nobody knows what he's really trying to pass here because it hasn't been properly vetted. Hopefully, he'll actually respect the committees, respect the Pentagon, start working with them, and they can attach it to the National Defense Authorization Act. That's the right way to do it. Again, it's not like I was opposed to it. I just was opposed to trying to pass something that nobody even knew what was in it, and it had gone from the price has increased tenfold. So no, I was just trying to block an awful end run around the process.
This week, President Trump formally nominated his former personal lawyer, Todd Blanche, to serve as the nation's next attorney general. We talked with Senator Tammy Baldwin about this, pointing to Blanche's support of Trump's controversial anti-weaponization fund. Are you at all worried about Blanche's ability to act independently of the president's wishes?
No, not to the extent I'm worried about any attorney general working with the president. I mean, it's just kind of a nature of the beast here. Okay. But I completely support the Judgment Fund, which has been around since 1957. It compensates people who have been harmed, abused by the federal government on both sides of the political spectrum. Obama used it. Biden used it. Pays out about $2 billion a year. This is not something unique. You know, obviously, I would not support paying out compensation to people who committed acts of violence or vandalism, that type of thing. But you know, for example, in Wisconsin, Judge Troupas is being abused by the federal government and by Josh Call. That has to end. It's destroying him. He's one of the people who should qualify for compensation.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Have a good day.
That is Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. We heard Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin on the show earlier this week. And to note, Senator Johnson referenced Jim Troupas, President Trump's 2020 Wisconsin campaign lawyer, who is facing 11 criminal counts of forgery for his role in developing the false elector scheme to try to overturn the 2020 election. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, it's this week's edition of Inside Wisconsin Politics. Subsidies for Wisconsin childcare providers are set to run out at the end of the month. The team from WPR and PBS Wisconsin look at the policy and politics behind childcare funding. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As school lets out for the summer, subsidies for Wisconsin childcare providers are set to run out at the end of the month, and that could create higher expenses for parents across the state. At the same time, college students are facing higher costs of their own, with the Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents approving a 2% tuition increase. Our team of political reporters at Inside Wisconsin Politics are looking at the political battles that preceded both looming changes, plus a $10 million PFAS settlement with Tyco. Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So, Anya, how do we get to this point with this child care subsidy that is about to run out right at a point in an election cycle and a year where costs are already this massive factor on everybody's minds?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a story that we've all been covering incrementally for years and years. And when I say incrementally, what I mean is people ringing that alarm bell that we were heading towards this cliff. So go back in time to COVID. There were federal subsidies put in place for the child care industry. While everything else is collapsing, this is one of these things. And so the Child Care Counts program was initiated, which in Wisconsin looked like about $300 million going to child care providers for things like paying staff more, to retain them, infrastructure needs, material needs, and also some amount of financial aid for families that were struggling. And so that was due to expire. And so then for years, we were all covering legislative fights over what to do about this funding that was going to go away. program finally sunset last summer, and then a bridge program took over. And so now it is the bridge program that is due to expire. So again, we've sort of been pushing off this cliff for years and years and years. And now the thing that advocates and providers have been warning about is about to happen. This new report came out last week saying that potentially up to a quarter of childcare providers could close their doors, and almost certainly more than that are going to raise tuition after all of these funds go away.
And Rich, this is an issue where the Democratic governor and Republican legislature definitely have not seen eye to eye when it comes to subsidizing childcare. Refresh my memory a little bit on how they did see eye to eye a year ago and how they got this money that is about to run out now.
So it goes back to this fight over $171 million. Governor Evers had access to this money, which was interest from those federal COVID-era stimulus funds. So the interest generated from that is Wisconsin revenue, in a sense. So there was this political battle. Republicans said, well, that should be under our control, or we should have a say in how you spend that. The governor said, no, this is federal money. And I remember watching a hearing on a bill that would have essentially given the legislature a lot more say over that money. And even an attorney with the nonpartisan legislative council said, well, it's kind of an open question. You know, they didn't answer it specifically, but that was a political battle. And during that discussion on the bill, one of the authors, Republican Eric Wimberger, toyed with the idea he mused about impeaching Governor Evers over this money. So that bridge fund tapped into that interest from the COVID stimulus funds, and that's how they were able to at least keep this program going to some extent. The providers were saying it's not enough. A Democrat said it's not enough, but here we are, and that's what's been keeping the thing afloat.
So Tony Evers said, it's very important to me that we keep this child care subsidy going. And Republicans said, well, it's very important to us that you get this money out of your bank account, Governor Evers. And so they found that agreement for a year. But Zach, it feels like now the money really is going to run out. Are providers going to close? What's going to happen?
Well, you're going to hear a lot of noise about it, and that's for sure. And there's a reality on the ground of what it means for providers and for parents specifically, who have to figure out where their kids are going to go if they can't afford this and still need to go work. But in a political season like this, this is going to be top-line messaging, especially for the Democrats running for governor. Republicans in the past in the legislature, and we assume Tom Tiffany's kind of in this category, have looked at, you know, the private sector means of trying to fix this childcare issue of like, oh, let's lower regulations, let's find some discounts or some savings elsewhere, but instead of directly funding them. They've never liked that welfare idea, as Robin Voss would constantly call it. And so we don't see Republicans coming back to the table. This wasn't part of the grand bargain that we talked about for a month straight. So this is a dead issue politically. There's no one coming back in special session to find money to fix this. They've all known this date is here. The question is, what will it mean going into the fall? How much damage will we see leading up to September? And maybe because September means school's back in session, it'll be a little less of a hot button issue, but there will still be people talking about it, and there will be Democrats campaigning on it, especially since they have a forum coming up that's invited to all the gubernatorial candidates, but five of the Democrats are going to appear to it. And it's being held by these child care providers and some of the groups that represent them, where they're just going to try to keep raising the profile of this heading into the fall.
And I mean, it's kind of a subjective question here, but like, do you feel like this particular cost will resonate with people at the time when we're paying so much for gas and everything else? Does childcare kind of, get people's attention when they have all this noise?
If you have a child in your house that you have to pay childcare for, yes. I remember 15, 20 years ago, long before this was an issue, I had family friends that said, I would actually save money by staying home and quitting my job and not making my truck payment and paying gas and insurance and taxes and not having to pay childcare. That was a long time ago, and it's still the reality even more so. I mean, more people than ever need to have two incomes to fund even a modest lifestyle in Wisconsin. And if you have small children, that means they need to go somewhere. As more and more families have split apart from the nuclear larger umbrella of grandma or grandpa or aunts or uncles are around, you're relying on other people to raise your kids. That is just the reality that people are in right now. And if it's your reality, it's one of the biggest realities facing you.
And Anya, any sense that this might affect specific races, whether it be the race for governor, you name it?
I mean, I think one of the interesting things here is that childcare as like a need and as a household expense really spans. It spans the state, it spans political backgrounds. Where that's not as much reflected is in the Capitol, where you have a little bit more of these hardline positions, especially within the Republican caucus in the Assembly. There is a small but significant enough number of lawmakers who do believe in a more traditional family structure, who don't want to be subsidizing other people raising your children. And they are really trying to kind of legislate around that. And so it's not just about those sort of market solutions. And so I think that at that level, at the legislative level, we might really see this issue come to the fore, because people who kind of don't care about some of those more cultural fights, they just want a little bit more money and a little bit more ease in their bank accounts. Will those people be motivated by not just this, but this in combination with gas prices and inflation? And then also, there's at least one district where one of these child care providers turned advocate is now running for a seat in the legislature. I don't know that this will be her only issue, but this will be one of her strongest issues. And that'll be really interesting to watch how resonant this is through the summer.
That'd be Corrine Hendrickson, I believe,
exactly right.
A Democratic candidate. She's in a primary with Lisa White and Representative Jenna Jacobson against Howard Markline, the powerful co-chair of the legislature's budget committee.
One of the most hotly watched races anyways.
And he has really been clear that he does not support this. This is not an issue where there's kind of gray between what Democrats support and what Republicans support with this child care subsidy. There are stark differences. And so if they want to have that kind of debate out there, it would be certainly a chance for voters to see a difference in the way that these two parties view this issue in government.
And that's why it was probably really helpful to have Rich's background of how we got to this point, because some people may be confused to think there was a bipartisan solution to provide this funding. From COVID on, it was all federal money that Governor Evers directed into this program when the federal money ran out, with Republicans fighting it every step of the way, repeatedly passing bills that said, we would like oversight in how this federal money gets spent, so you can't make that decision unilaterally. Governor Evers vetoed every one of those bills. And it was this compromise, and the last time was not a compromise of, oh, we believe this should happen. It was, how do we spend this other pot of money that's still sitting here? So the COVID money is gone. This is now on the state's back, or we will see the consequences in households and businesses across the state.
And you alluded to this earlier, but I was looking back through public statements from the leaders as this big deal was negotiated, the deal that fizzled. And I don't think anybody was ever talking about putting some money behind childcare as much as the governor has said it's a priority for him. So that kind of gives you the sense of the politics on that one. Rich, we've got another cost going up here for some Wisconsin residents or out-of-state residents who come here to go to school. Tuition going up at the University of Wisconsin. How much, first of all, and give us a sense of how this came to be.
Well, so the tuition increase, specifically for tuition that the Board of Regents has approved, is 2%, but there's another 3.5% increase with regard to what are called segregated fees. You name it, fees for facilities, et cetera, et cetera. So we're talking 2%, which is below the rate of inflation, of course. But the argument over tuition, I'm not sure if it ever had a beginning or an end, but this specifically goes back to 2013, when there was a tuition freeze after Republicans found out and loudly complained for years and years that the University of Wisconsin system had something like $500 to $600 million in what are called fund balances, tuition fund balances, essentially reserves. And they had those reserves at a time when tuition had increased by 5.5% year after year after year. So that created a lot of heartburn among Republicans, and that in 2013, there was the tuition freeze. Not long after that, Republicans, when they had both houses of the legislature and Governor Walker in the governor's mansion, they cut $250 million from the UW budget, essentially saying, you've got those reserves, spend them down. So the universities had these directions to spend down the reserves, and they did. Over the years, the reserves went down by 60%. Some universities wound up in the red and had to do some pretty you know, stark things to get their budgets under control. We saw layoffs. We saw a lot of buyouts. You know, I think of Oshkosh, you know, Marathon, Stevens Point. A number of universities did that. So the tuition freeze was lifted officially in 2021. The university system, the Board of Regents, tread carefully at first. They didn't immediately ask for a tuition increase. But since then, we've seen four consecutive tuition increases from the Board of Regents. And they haven't been the 5.5%. They've generally been close to or below CPI, which, you know, is pretty high. But Republicans don't like it. And even when they lifted the tuition freeze in 2021, some Republican lawmakers said, be careful. If you, you know, get out of hand with this, we will freeze it again. So what we're seeing now is some Republicans, Tom Tiffany, running for governor, saying we need another tuition freeze. That freeze lasted for 8 years. Universities said it was harming, you know, quality of education. But on the other hand, Republicans said this is about access. This is about affordability. So, you know, the tuition increases back to back to back is just not good for Wisconsin families. But also, the university says our tuition rates are lower than other states. So it's a really complex issue, and it's just been years and years since they've been complaining and arguing over this.
So certainly not. Somebody might be forgiven to look at that increase 2% and say, hey, what's the big deal? But this is something that goes back, boy, 16 years or 13 years at this point now that they've been fighting over this particular round of tuition. I think it's an open question on this issue, like any other. Is this going to be something that resonates in the campaign for governor? Anya, how about you go first?
I mean, in some ways, I think that the arguments that we're seeing from Democrats and Republicans mirrors the property tax and K-12 funding thing, right? Which is that you have these kind of levers, and as you pull one, another one goes up. And so in this case, Democrats are saying, well, the state has been defunding the UW system. What do you expect? Of course, tuition is going to have to go up. But one of those, you know, they're sort of in balance with one another. I think another point of tension that's going to be really interesting is the way that this affects Madison and in some ways Milwaukee compared to all the other schools, because Madison especially has this international cachet, right, and can bring in students from out of state and from across the world who will pay full freight, and that offsets some of those costs in a way that Stevens Point, Oshkosh are much more kind of aimed at local Wisconsin kids. You have Tom Tiffany now coming out and saying he wants to see fewer international students. He wants to put the W back in the UW. What will that do for this kind of other revenue source that UW-Madison has and how that feeds into the system? Lots to play with, and to what extent that motivates voters who, again, maybe they face the daycare charges. Now they're facing increased tuition on the other end. It's expensive to raise a kid in Wisconsin.
It could really be, whether or not it resonates could just be a matter of whether or not Tom Tiffany decides to put some resources behind it and put it in front of people and make it his message, or focus on other stuff.
There's a lot out there. And one of the things that's interesting is a report just came out from the Center for Report on the Wisconsin Economy, which is CROW, which is this conservative think tank that was created by Walker in his administration at the UW with the goal of having a little more conservative-friendly economics ideas being floated out there as from the UW, giving it that stamp of authenticity. And they came out and said, actually, UW's tuition is too low. It's below its peer institutions. It's actually freezing it is subsidizing this private enterprise of kids that go to college and get this degree and then are very successful, making their college tuition cheaper, subsidizes them at the expense of everyone else who's impacted by these costs. So it's interesting, even some of the conservative groups out there aren't supporting a freeze or keeping it this low.
Zach, I want to turn to another issue with a long political backstory. There was this settlement this week or last week reached with Tyco, a PFAS manufacturer, for $10 million with the state. This is a big deal. Tell us why, and then tell us kind of the politics that led to this.
Well, these lawsuits have been out there about PFAS contamination throughout. Tyco makes firefighting foam and equipment, and so they've contaminated the ground around there as we've learned more about what PFAS does, and it's the forever chemical. But the history of this is fascinating because we talk a lot about elections having consequences. This decision is a consequence of Supreme Court elections. So you have to go back and look at that slow transition that occurred from Democrats and liberals taking over the court, because there were two major decisions that they issued in 2025 that allowed this to happen. The first is that with the DOJ lawsuit, they said you do not actually have to create a new rule for each version of PFAS chemical or contamination that's out there in order to put into place these kind of fines or sue people over the Wisconsin Spills Act about any things that spilled into our ground that can harm our waterways. So that was a big win that said you don't have to go back each time. But then another separate lawsuit, part of the Evers versus Markline lawsuit said, well, the state doesn't actually have to go and worry about the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules to promulgate new rules for what the standards for PFAS are. And so when that happened, the Evers administration was able to push through new standards on PFAS contamination that matched stricter federal standards. Now the DOJ doesn't have to worry about getting sign-off from the Republicans for settling these lawsuits, and they can actually prosecute this Spills Act for anyone that's out there that's contaminated the ground, which allows settlements like this to happen and creating money to help people that have been impacted by this pollution.
So you're not going to see any of that in the settlement language, obviously, but that's the legal environment that everybody is operating in now under this liberal majority on the court, which we know is going to last until at least 2030.
Yeah, and it's not going to change anytime soon.
And on other issues, perhaps as well, in subtle ways, but you got
the court matters. That's why we watch the court.
The court always matters. That is very true. Mm-hmm. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us.
That was a roundtable with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer. Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org. If you have a question you'd like the reporters to discuss, email it to InsideWisconsinPolitics@WPR.org. Please include your first and last name in your message. Coming up, Andre DeShields started his theater career at UW-Madison. At age 80, he just performed at the Tony Awards. He shares lessons from his career and encourages people to stay creative at every age.
The top of one mountain is the bottom of the next. So keep climbing.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about exploring the depths of space.
Photographers tend to spend a lot of time with their subjects. For astrophotographer Rick Wayne of Madison, his subject for much of his life has been space. What started off as an interest in taking better pictures soon became something much greater, a sense of glory. And on one clear night, Alexandra Salmon joined Wayne to take photographs of the night sky.
Okay, so this here is a tracking mount. It's an equatorial mount. This was two checks from Grandma Lynn's worth of money, and maybe a little contribution from my wife, too.
That's Rick Wayne, software engineer by day, amateur astrophotographer by night. We're at the Yana Astronomical Research Station in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, surrounded by crickets, owls, and a clearing in the trees with a perfect opening to the starry night.
Not to snow you with tech talk, but this is an 8-inch Ritchie Chrétien astrograph, which is to say it's a reflector telescope.
So with the images that you produce, is that what is actually out in space if we were to be space?
That is a terrific question. If you were out in space and looked at it, you would see nothing because these gases are a pretty good vacuum. But part of it is also because the camera is integrating. There are only a few photons hitting the sensor every second, and your eyes can only integrate about a quarter of a second at a time. So the camera can do it for you know, hours if I tell it. Technical reasons, you wouldn't do that. Something like the Andromeda Galaxy, which is just in an image with lots of integration time, it bursts with color and it's just gobsmackingly gorgeous. In most telescopes, it looks like, oh yeah, there's some fuzzy stuff and a couple of stars there. And that's what most of these deep space objects look to the eye. And it would be pretty much the same if you were out there in space, even close up looking at them. This part, this can here, is a thermoelectrically cooled monochrome astro camera, which means that it's just taking in photons. It doesn't care what color they are.
Mm-hmm.
This in front of it is a filter wheel. And if you look, you can see one of the filters there.
The images are obviously, I mean, they're so beautiful. And I wonder if you ever feel like looking up at space does something for you that looking around here on Earth doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's stuff going on up there. You don't get a sense of the forces at play in the universe and the really deep history. You can't see that on Earth. The old Carl Sagan saying that we're all stardust. You know, every atom in our bodies that is higher up the periodic table than iron was built in a supernova explosion, or else in the Big Bang. That's the only place those atoms come from. And yet here we are, you know, we're tiny little insignificant specks of matter, and yet that's our whole world is built out of stuff that came out of supernova explosions.
That's wild.
It is. And looking up there, you know, you get thoughts like that when you do it.
Alexandra Salmon is an independent radio producer who lives in Madison. She brought us that story on astrophotographer Rick Wayne. And what you're hearing now, sonifications of Hubble images converted into sound by NASA. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. Last weekend, Broadway legend and UW-Madison alum Andre DeShields performed at the Tony Awards, where he was nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Featured Role in a Musical. Here he is as Old Deuteronomy in Cats the Jellicle Ball, a new reimagining of the hit musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber.
My legs may be tottering. I must go slow and be careful of the
DeShields earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in English Literature at UW-Madison in 1970. After that, he began performing in Chicago, then on to Broadway. DeShields was last nominated for a Tony in 2019 when he won for his role as Hermes in the musical Hadestown. He joined Rob Fair to talk about his journey from his young adulthood in Wisconsin to his role in Cats the Jellicle Ball.
Well, you just performed with a cast of Cats, the Jellicle Ball, at the Tony Awards over the weekend. That show, it's rooted in the ballroom culture, this subculture centered around a style of dance from the 60s to the 80s in New York, the underground Black and Latino LGBTQ community. What kind of message and feeling and energy were you trying to bring to this national primetime audience as you capture the flavor of that show?
One message, and that is, we are all in this together, or we're not in it at all. Ballroom is populated by citizens who have been traditionally marginalized to the edges of society. But here we are in the first quarter of the 21st century, and things are leaning toward a new paradigm, I believe. And this paradigm is about embracing. This paradigm is about empathy. This paradigm is about everybody. Let your freak flag fly.
Now, as that ballroom culture was emerging, so was the career of André Deschildes. Were you aware of that ballroom culture? You were coming at it from Madison and then Chicago and then eventually to New York. Was this part of your life then?
I can't say that it was part of my life, but growing up in Baltimore, Maryland, I was aware of it. This is before I went away to go to college and before I lived as a Chicago actor and before I arrived in New York in 1973, when indeed it was a vibrant underground movement for people who wanted to live their distinctly authentic lives, but there still was no above ground outlet for it.
You grew up in Baltimore. You went to school briefly, I think, in Ohio. What made you look at Madison and UW-Madison and say, that's the place for me now?
I had gone to college initially at a Quaker school in Ohio, all the way through my junior year abroad. When I returned from Europe in 1967, politically speaking, things were a hotbed across American campuses, and I wanted to be where the action was. So I applied to other universities, and the University of Wisconsin accepted me on a similar work-study scholarship that I had done at Williamson College. And it turned out, when I arrived there, I personally became part of the movement that gave the first Black Studies department to the top 10 state schools, one of them being the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
It looks like it was a pretty wild time for theater at UW-Madison, a lot of experimental work that you were involved in with people like the late Stuart Gordon, who went on to found theater companies and direct horror movies. What was that spirit of experimentation and innovation? What did that mean for you at that time?
It meant for me a way into the craft that I wanted to practice. Now, there was a vibrant theater community within the student body at the University of Wisconsin, but I never had an opportunity to work on the main stage there. I auditioned for pieces, but never was my name on the list. This had also happened with a few other students who were admittedly left on the political scale. So Stuart Gordon, a young colleague of mine at the school, decided to, and I think I can say this on radio, screw theater, which became the title of our group that went on to experiment with ideas of our own conception. And then ultimately, Stuart returned to Chicago, his home, and founded the Organic Theater Company. And he invited me to join that once I had graduated.
We're talking with Tony Award-winning Broadway legend and UW-Madison alum André Deschildes, nominated for a Tony Award for his role as Old Deuteronomy in Cats, the Jellicle Ball. André, you're 80 years old, and you are performing at the Tonys up for an award. You have, you told NPR recently, you have a part of your mission is to advocate for the senior citizen who wants to be active as an artist. What kind of advice do you have for people in their 70s and 80s to not give up that creative life?
Okay. I don't know if you're aware of my Tony acceptance speech from 2019 when I did win the Tony Award for Best Featured Actor in a Musical. But I shared three cardinal rules. with the 9 million viewers. The final rule is the top of one mountain is the bottom of the next. So keep climbing. And that was particularly meant for my senior siblings, because we get dealt a hard deal in an active industry like theater the older we become. But we're still kicking, just not so high. So I am happy to stand as a mascot for that senior citizen who continues to climb mountains.
Turning to younger actors, you're obviously in a cast with people of a variety of ages. There's a UW-Madison scholarship named after you now to award grants to undergraduate students to perform, to create art. What do you try to share with that younger generation to follow in some of the things you did, experiment, try new things, and like you said earlier, let that freak flag fly?
Here's the big lesson for my children and grandchildren to learn. And I continue to learn it. Pursue only those blessings which have your name written upon them. Everybody's parents have said to them, not all that glitters is gold. Not every goodbye is gone. Not every shut eye is asleep. The universe is a cornucopia, and its purpose is to spill nothing but blessings to those of us who are the microcosm version of its macrocosm. If we show gratitude for its generosity, we will never go astray. It's only when we are pursuing blessings that are not intended for us that we find things difficult. So I'm reminding the young people who see so much that looks attractive. Abundance has your name on it. Pursue that.
And finally, Andre, as we speak, the nation is observing Pride Month, celebrating the LGBTQ community of today and those who paved the way for rights in the past. What significance does this month have for you?
Well, the significance is the current show in which I'm working that just won 3 Tony Awards, Cats, the Jellicle Ball, because now that we've come out of the closet, as it were, we are beginning to live out loud. And all people, regardless of sexual orientation, are coming to the show and celebrating, because what we're dropping on the people now is a joy bomb.
That's a great place to leave it. Andre, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That is Tony Award-winning actor Andre DeShields talking with host Rob Ferret. DeShields is known for his roles as Hermes in Hadestown and most recently Old Deuteronomy in Cats, the Jellicle Ball. In 1970, he earned an English literature degree from UW-Madison. DeShields performed with the cast of Cats at last weekend's Tony Awards, where he was nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Featured Role. We just heard from Broadway legend and UW-Madison alum Andre DeShields encouraging us to stay creative and curious, and even when we get up in years, go on, try new things. Have you picked up a new hobby or a new pursuit later in life? What did you learn to do? What did you find out about yourself in the process? Why did you stick with it? And in the words of Andre DeShields, how do you keep climbing? Tell us about your creative inspiration and what you're trying that's new. We'd love to incorporate your story in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence and Joe Tarr. Our acting executive producer is Tim Peterson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Brad Kohlberg. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.